Today is January 2nd, 2019. It's the first time I've said this year, 2019. My name is Deborah Schwartz, and I'm sitting here at the West Point Inn with Pat Williams, innkeeper Pat Williams, on behalf of the Mill Valley Public Library and the Mill Valley Historical Society. And I'm sitting in this lovely cottage eating homemade cinnamon bread made by innkeeper David Doerr on a perfect winter's day with views all around in a building I call the crown, the jewel in the crown, which is the West Point Inn. And very happy to be sitting with my friend and mountain lover, Pat Williams. Pat, first of all, thank you for taking the time today.
My pleasure, Deborah.
And to sit and tell your stories. Now, I know you're a good storyteller.
You've heard.
I've heard a few. And I've heard about some of them, too. And so this is always fun to interview somebody who's a natural storyteller. And but you're more than a storyteller. You've been a fireman. You were a fireman for 31 years, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you worked at the...
I worked at the Ross Valley Fire Department. Before that, I worked for Larkspur and the County of Marin as a fire lookout on top of Mount Tamalpais.
Yes.
So my journey to Marin County was a long adventure, but it was a destiny I think I was meant for. I grew up in a family of eight, the oldest of eight. My dad was a military officer. My mom was a nurse. And we traveled around the world. I was being firstborn. I was born in San Francisco along with two of my sisters.
And what year was that?
1948. Mm-hmm. And my dad was a student at the University of San Francisco. And mom was a nurse at St. Mary's. And my parents were childhood sweethearts. My mom was 11 and my dad was 13 when they first met, and they were in love their entire life.
And where did they meet, and what are their names?
So they met in Reno, Nevada, and that's where they grew. My mother's name was Mary Jane Rippingham. She comes from a long line of miners. They came over for the Comstock load. Her grandfather built a house in Virginia City. He worked in Virginia City, and the house that he built is still standing on C Street, the main street in Virginia City.
And what was her father's, her parents?
Her father's name was Joseph Patrick Rippingham, and my name, first name is Patrick, and I was named after him and one of my uncles.
And her mother?
Her mother's name was Josephine Rippingham, and she came from Minnesota. She came out to Tonopah, Nevada, where she met my grandfather, and that's where my mother was born and lived in Tonopah, Nevada. Then they moved to Reno, and my grandmother worked as a nurse at St. Mary's Hospital, mm-hmm. and my grandfather was disabled and ran a small tobacco store right underneath the sign in Reno that said the greatest little city in the world, the biggest little city in the
right.
world.
And
right under that was a little tobacco store, and my grandfather was on crutches or a wheelchair his entire life, and so he ran that store, and everybody in Reno knew him. His name was Joe Rippingham.
And so I have to ask, was it a military injury, or did polio?
No, it was, nobody quite knows why, but he would get sores on his legs and stuff, and eventually had to have his leg amputated. Mm-hmm. But the doctors could never figure out what the cause was of his illnesses. It was poor circulation in his legs was mm-hmm. But they don't know what caused it.
And again, your mother and father's names?
So my father's name is Francis Williams. Mm-hmm. His father was did all kinds of different jobs and traveled along. My dad was born in Michigan, at Kalamazoo, Michigan, where my great-grandfather ran a university there and was pretty well-known mathematician. Stories in the family was that when he was doing an internship at the University of Heidelberg that Albert Einstein submitted his theory of relativity to my grandfather for review.
And what's your grandfather's name?
Benedict Williams.
And so he was living,
he did an internship. He was at a university in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And I think it was Case Western, if I remember right, but I'm not certain on that. I've got family records of that, but I haven't looked at them for a long time.
I mean, you're a blue-eyed, fair-haired fella, so I'm guessing your ancestry is...
Irish. Yep. I just recently had my DNA done, and I thought it was more English than Irish.
Because you look a little English.
It turns out my genes are 60% Irish, so which was surprising, but I've always considered myself Irish, too. So, but I assumed it was... probably be more English. And there's German and some Swedish, which I didn't know. And so, as all of us, we all have our makeup is different.
So you've had an American ancestry for some generations then?
Quite a few. On my father's side, the Williams family came over and landed in Bar Harbor, Maine. And related to Roger Williams, who founded Providence, Rhode Island, and mm-hmm. is considered the father of the freedom of religion, which is some irony. And I've done some family research on that. I'm a direct descendant of Robert Williams, who was Roger Williams' brother. Mm-hmm. So Roger Williams would have been a great uncle so many generations ago.
But we didn't ask about your grandmother on your father's side. I mean, I didn't hear about her, did I?
So I don't know. Her name was Catherine Losey. Mm-hmm. She came from kind of an aristocratic family from Reno, Nevada, mm-hmm. and there were a number of judges in her family and involved in law, but I don't know too much about her. She was a wonderful woman, very proper, but I was probably closer to my grandparents on my mother's side.
When you think about Reno as being the biggest little city in the world, they were there before there were casinos.
I think the casinos were there.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
right
from the get-go? No, the casinos go quite a ways back in Reno. Yeah.
Ah.
So, but they were, and my grandfather knew them all. I mean, he knew all the characters and the players in the casinos and was friends with them. So, he was good friends with Joe Conforti, who had a ring of prostitution houses.
Uh-huh.
He was friends with the priest from the local parish would come into his house. And when he finally had to retire, you know, they would just walk in and go into the liquor cabinet, pour a shot of whiskey, and then come out and talk to my grandfather. And so I spent a lot of time with my dad being in the military, and when he was in the Korean War, we stayed with my grandmother in Reno. So we kind of Reno was always hometown for me, uh-huh. but I always felt an affinity for the Bay Area because I was born here, mm-hmm. and had always hoped to come back here. And my dad always applied for the Presidio as a job to be. Yeah, he did it over 30 years in the military and retired as a bird colonel. And he's still alive today. He lives in Mill Valley. He'll be 94 here in a few weeks.
Oh, my. Yeah. How lucky for you.
Yeah.
I mean, how
yeah.
fortunate to have yeah. your pops around.
Yeah. Yeah. He's not doing well, but...
Do I know him? Would I have seen him?
No, I don't think you would have seen him. Yeah. He has to have 24-hour care now. And lives off of 3rd and Main in Sausalito.
I see.
So we grew up around the world. Mm-hmm. We left when I was 4 years old. My dad was, we left San Francisco and went back to Reno because my dad was in the Korean War. Mm-hmm. And then he was injured in the Korean War and was transported to Kyoto, Japan to a military hospital. And my mother took myself and my two sisters and put us on a steamship out of Fort Mason in San Francisco and the piers there on a military transport ship and took us to Japan. And I still remember a little bit of that even though I was 4 years old, but she just did this on her own. And I remember we all had to have leashes on to, because we're on this rolling ship. And so here's my mother with three little children trying to control that. And I was old enough to remember that that trip and going to, we got off in Japan, and of course nobody spoke English, and my mother's trying to figure, everything's in Japanese, and we got on a train, and we headed up north, and we got up to the Fukushima area where that nuclear power plant blew up recently. Uh-huh. Well, you know, this would have been in the early 50s, and we got turned around, and somebody realized we were lost and helped us and got us back to Kyoto. But we wound up living in Japan for about a year and a half while my dad recuperated, and then he was later assigned there. And I learned how to speak a little bit of Japanese as a child. And
Konnichiwa.
Yeah, arigato. So it was from there we just traveled the world. We lived in Italy for 3 years, and I was involved with the Boy Scouts from the time I was 11 years old until I was in my mid-teens, and that was kind of a focus. I really enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. So growing up, we lived in 3 countries and 14 different states.
Oh my.
Yeah, my dad's job, as he advanced through the ranks, he was a nuclear missile officer and was in charge of medium-range nuclear missiles, which is a really important job. And yes, he had some interesting stories about that. But
so how did you... So you grew up all... You're a rather continental fellow, aren't you?
I guess I could consider that, yeah, for international continent.
Yes.
So I grew up and was exposed to a lot of the world and learned that people everywhere are pretty much the same. So I did a lot of reading, a lot of studying. Growing up, I loved science, always wanted to be an astronaut. That was kind of a goal. And still would like to add that to my resume. I didn't do well in high school. I goofed off a lot, procrastinated a lot. I still have that trait. And in traveling the world, it was hard because every year was a different school.
Right.
I went. My high school years were Washington State, and then my sophomore year in Kansas at Leavenworth, Kansas, where I got in a bit of trouble and stole a car, and ran away from home, and a whole nother story. Stole a car from under the front gates of Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary, and didn't know how to drive, and the culprit that was with me. We got all the way into Nebraska before we got caught.
And you're how old? What, 17?
I was 15.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So a little influence from my friend who was a year older than I was. And it all worked out. It turned out the car we stole belonged to the provost marshal, which is like the judge on a military base.
Oh, so, and your dad was military.
And so. My dad was military. So and by this time, we had my parents had 8 kids, so it was hard. It was hard being in a family with 8 kids and on the move all the time, and we were living in military housing. So, yeah.
I've interviewed a few people that have had military histories, and it can be difficult, alienating, and I've heard complaints, but you don't seem to be complaining too much.
No, well, one of the things you learn to do is you make friends fast, you learn how to read people you make friends, but then you wind up losing friends after a year because you're moving, and you learn to communicate by letters and what have you. But
so, in essence, you're a kind of an adaptable guy?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, after high school, this would have been what year did you graduate from?
Well, I graduated in 1966, but before that, I was a junior in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. My dad was doing graduate work at the University of Alabama at the time, and that's when I met Martin Luther King, and I also met Bobby Sheldon, who was the Grand Imperial Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. Mm-hmm. Tuscaloosa was kind of the hub of the universe for all the racial stuff that was going on at the time, and so was Birmingham and Selma, which is 60 miles south of Tuscaloosa. That happened all during the time that I lived down there. And I was involved in this secret organization to integrate the high school that I was at down down there?
A secret organization, because had people been aware of what you were doing as a big, tall, blue-eyed white guy?
And a Yankee, because we were guests down there. Yeah. My dad was only at the university to do 2 years of graduate work, and we were told, do not get involved in that. But that's not the way we were raised. We were all raised to be active and participating in things, but my dad was concerned. We did. Both my sister and I got in trouble, and she got in trouble with the Ku Klux Klan, and I pulled some stuff that probably shouldn't have done, like when they had cross burnings down at the Black Warrior River. We would wait till they light the cross on fire and stand on this hill and launch cherry bombs down on top of them. So
we being?
Three of my buddies that I kind of palled around with. So kid stuff, but dangerous kid stuff to be doing at that time.
You were a small cadre of resistance.
Yeah. Well, it was more because it was exciting, I think. And we didn't like the Klan. We didn't like what they stood for. So.
So after you pelted them with cherry bombs, did you just hightail it or ran the
other
direction?
Oh, I spent the night in a blackberry thicket bush. Yeah, they were looking for me. And had they found us, I wouldn't be here talking to you. Yeah, they would have tarred and feathered us, wrapped us in chains, and thrown us in the bottom of the Black Warrior River. That's the way they dealt with you, if you were...
Rather sobering for a young...
Yeah.
...person. And may I ask your impression of Martin Luther King?
So, how I met Martin Luther King was, I was... my best friend in Tuscaloosa was a black guy who drove a Cushman motorcycle for Rexall Drugstore. He delivered pharmacy stuff on a motorcycle. And at the time, I had a summer job working selling ice cream in one of those ice cream carts that you pedal with the bells. And he and I became good friends. And we would sit out because the drugstore was in the front, and around the back was this... guy that had a business with all these bicycles and stuff. And anyway, we just hit it off. We were good friends. And so I got to know him and his parents and stuff, but he wound up having to break off our friendship because his boss came out one day when we were sitting out in front having a Coca-Cola, and his boss came out and said, "I ever see you talking to this white boy again, you're fired." And he couldn't afford to get fired.
Because he was a black man?
The black, yeah. He was about my age.
Mm-hmm. But he was a black guy.
He was a black guy, yeah.
Oh, so.
So, you know, needless to say, that really upset me. And anyway, it was...
And then Martin...
I was... The Martin Luther King, he came to Tuscaloosa when Jack Palance was a movie star who was from Tuscaloosa. Mm-hmm. And he came back there because he had a new Western movie out. This would have been in 64. And... 1964. He came out and went to the movie theater with his black nanny, who pretty much raised him, to take her to see this movie. And of course, the theater was not integrated. No blacks could go into
the actor, the star of the show,
star of the movie,
brings in his nanny.
Right. And so word got out that he was trying to do this. And so the Klan, you know, made a big deal. And of course, he made a big deal about it too. And it became national news because he was saying this is ridiculous. So the Klan came out and tried to prevent that from happening. And so there was this big standoff going on. So the blacks in Tuscaloosa had about enough of this separate water fountains and having to ride in the back of the bus and not getting jobs. And so they staged a protest during this thing because, one, the national cameras were on Tuscaloosa at the time. They had been in the past, because of George Wallace standing on the steps of the University of Alabama in 1963. So anyway, there was a big march, protest asking for civil rights. And I was standing on the corner and I was the only white kid around.
And it should be noticed for those that don't see you, like I see you, you're not a little guy.
No, I'm 6'4".
Yes, yeah.
I was tall, skinny, 6'4", you know, at the time.
Hard to miss.
Yeah. So I was standing on the corner clapping when I saw them walking up the street. Tuscaloosa was shaped like had two main streets at that time, and a courthouse kind of sat at the intersection of the two main streets. And so I was standing across the street from the courthouse and was applauding. And somebody from Dr. King came out. There were three black limos came up just about a block before and parked. And then the group of blacks that were marching had stopped. And Dr. King got out of his car and several other people, I think Ralph Abernathy was there and mm-hmm. I think some other people. But they got out and they got in the front and they're going up there. And so I'm standing there. I just instinctively started to clap. And somebody from Dr. King's party came over and said, Dr. King would like to meet you. And I walked over and he said, thank you, son. He said, I'm getting a little choked up about this. But he said, would you walk with us? And I said, sir, I can't. I said, my father, I started to tell him about my father being at the university and he'd get in trouble. And he said, I understand, son. So I went back over there and I went, wow. But I thought I was disappointed because they got to the courthouse and then probably because Dr. King and they had something else going on, but they got back in the limo and drove away. And about that time, the Tuscaloosa Police Department showed up and started cracking heads and turned into a full-blown riot. And I was witness to the whole thing. So it left a big impression on me. So.
Now, Jack Palance is a singular actor. I mean, he has a sort of presence. He's not like a, I guess you could say he's almost kind of sinister. Can you do an imitation of him?
I mean, no, I never met him, and I never actually saw him.
So, I mean, this isn't, having an actor like of this caliber and of with his particular physical and presence. Take a stand. I mean, this is...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there were a lot of people taking stands at that time. And I applaud him for doing that. It needed to happen. You know, it was a big part of our history in the 20th century of what happened down in Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia at that time.
And radiating in different degrees out and around all over the country. It may not have been so blatant, but the ubiquitous... radiation of that kind of racism.
So, I mean, that's tells you a little bit where I'm from. At the time, I was struggling a bit at home and at school because of different schools, different curriculums every year. And my dad had told me, well, your senior year is going to be split between Tuscaloosa High School and a university or a high school in Virginia, because he's being transferred to the Pentagon, and they were planning on living in Springfield, Virginia. So I didn't want to split my year. So I actually joined the Navy when I turned 17 in Alabama. And part of my intent was I wanted to stay out of the Vietnam War. I wanted to go into submarines. So I went to boot camp and went on to a Catholic boys boarding school that I'd been as a freshman up in Washington State and graduated from the class of 50 students in 1966. But I was, as soon as I graduated, I was Navy property. And I went on active duty, reported to Treasure Island, because one of the first classes I had to take was electronic school. My goal was to be an electronic technician on nuclear submarines. And I had committed to 6.5 years in the Navy because they were going to put me through 4.5 years of schooling. Well, I went to Treasure Island, and it was 3 months before the next class started. So they found out I could type pretty well, so they had me doing yeoman work, doing reports and stuff, and tying up ships at Alameda.
You're back to where you were born.
I was back to where I was born, and I was loving it. And so I would get liberty on Saturday or Sunday night, and I would come over to San Francisco and spend most of my time on Market Street, this big city, because I hadn't really experienced a big city before in San Francisco, and it was my home. It's where I felt my
very different from the South in so many ways.
Yeah, it is completely different, and even as a kid, my dad he loved Herb Cain.
Yes,
and he had all of Herb Cain's books. And he had one that was signed by him, and I wound up inheriting those, unfortunately. I brought one to the brought them to the firehouse and they disappeared. But I remember reading those as a kid, and it just made my love for San Francisco grow that much stronger and making a determination that someday I'm going to live here.
But this is during the Vietnam War.
It was during the war.
So things are, for a young man, and you're doing your service, you're typing, you're all that, but were you ever worried about being enlisted into some action?
Well, it's one of the reasons I went in the Navy. I was going to submarine. Well, I was at Treasure Island and waiting for this, and the Navy had to do something with me. So they had a month-long firefighting school at Treasure Island.
Oh.
And I went through the structural firefighting school at Treasure Island and came in top of the class. I'd never come in top of the class in anything before, and I loved it. I fell in love with it, and I said, wow, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life, is be a firefighter. It was so much fun, and I knew every day would be something different. You know, it wouldn't be a boring job. At the time, I was thinking, well, I was toying with the idea at one time of being a priest, because that's what my parents wanted me to do. I also thought about being a lawyer, because that law really interested me. But then I decided I wanted to be a firefighter. So I went through that, and I would go out. There was a pier facing San Francisco, and I used to go out and sit at the end of that pier every night after chow until the sun went down. And I'd be out there, and I taught myself how to play a harmonica. And I would sit at the end of that pier and just play my harmonica very poorly, but there's nobody out there but me, and it'd be really cold. And I would just watch the sun go down over San Francisco and Mount Tam, and I'd look at this mountain off in the distance. I didn't know what the name of it was, but I could see it. I said, I'm going to be at the top of that mountain, so I'm going to climb to the top of that mountain someday. So anyway, while I was at Treasure Island, I never went to ET school because the war in Vietnam heated up and the Navy had other plans for me. So they sent me to, they said, you're going to Vietnam, you're going to be a riverboat coxswain. Which is, you're going to be the pilot of a riverboat.
Sort of like majorly dangerous, isn't it?
Yeah, it was very dangerous. So I wound up being detached to the Marine Corps and had to go through a partial Marine Corps training down at, for a month down at Camp Pendleton, where they kicked my behind big time.
Is it as brutal as the movie says it is?
It was, yeah, probably worse. Then I had to go to survival school, which they wound up shutting down after I was in Vietnam because the survival school was actually killing people.
Yes. Is that where they hold you underwater for a super long time and then bring you back so you know you aren't afraid of it?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Dear.
There's a lot of things they did to you and torture you. Because I was low rank, they didn't mess with me that much, but... if you're an officer, you get beat up pretty bad. So anyway, I went through that. And in January 4th of 1967, I arrived in Da Nang, Vietnam, and got put on they called them U-boats, which is kind of irony because U-boats were submarines in Germany. But these were LCUs, landing craft utilities. They're a big boat with a ramp in the front, the open deck. And we carried cargo and tanks and stuff to support the Marines. And there were three rivers that we would transport things to. My favorite was the Perfume River, which ran into the city of Hue. And Hue is an ancient city. Very dangerous. This is in 67. And you're getting shot at all the time. There were a lot of things that happened. First month there, I had a grenade go off next to me, literally 2 feet away from me. It should have killed me. It landed on the deck at 2 o'clock in the morning next to me because we were stuck on the river. I had piloted the boat into a sandbar, not knowing it, because the river changes all the time, and we were stuck in the sandbar. And so this old grizzly chief boatswain mate that was in charge of the boat, was screaming and yelling and said, you're going to stay up all night on watch. So I sat on the deck in a pouring rain with a cup of coffee and hot coffee in my lap, and I was sitting with my legs Indian style. And I had that cup of coffee in my lap and a Thompson machine gun underneath my poncho. And just sitting there dozing off because I'd been up piloting this boat all day, and here I was all night having to stand watch on the boat while everybody else was asleep, and it's pitch black, pouring rain. And I hear this pop, and this grenade lands on the deck. Now, mind you, this deck is just a real small. It's at the very front of the boat. on each side of the ramp that dropped down. So there was only enough room for me to sit. Probably, there probably isn't more than 10 or 15 square feet at the max. It lands, and there's a little lip that's about an inch high that runs along the edge. This grenade lands, and I'm sitting there staring at it, spin around, and figured, I'm done. And it was like an angel pushed it. It fell through the chock hole where you pass the rope, and it's the only place it could have gone. Rolled through there, and as soon as it dropped on the other side, it exploded, so I didn't have any shrapnel damage, but my hearing is, I've got tinnitus severely, and it's hard to... From that moment on.
Is this the U-boats that are in the movie with Martin Sheen, you know, the famous, what is that movie called?
I'm not sure which one.
You know, the terrible one with Martin Sheen.
Apocalypse Now.
Yeah. Yes.
So there were a lot of things in Apocalypse Now that were, you know, the helicopters coming in with the speakers blaring, that thing, that actually happened. I actually saw that happen. But a lot of it was Hollywood too.
But the boats. Yes.
There was not a U-boat in there. There were a number of different types of river craft, and there was a lot of that was based on the river. That kind of took place down in the Mekong Delta, down where John Kerry was on a swift boat. I was up north near the DMZ.
May I ask?
Sure.
You're sitting on that deck, half asleep, with your coffee and your gun and your rain gear. How old are you?
I was 18. I was going to be 19 in a few weeks. Yeah. I digressed a bit, but so the grenade goes off. So my natural instinct is pull the trigger on this machine gun, which has got 30 rounds of 45 caliber bullet in it on automatic. So this hot sizzling coffee that I had sitting in my lap now spills into my groin. So now my groin's on fire. I'm pulling this trigger on this machine gun and all 30 rounds go off, in just a couple of seconds. Shreds the poncho that I have in this pouring rain. Bullets and tracers are flying by my head, just woof by my face and stuff because it was an ambush.
Right.
And this went on for, seemed like forever, but it's probably only about 90 seconds. And I just remember I rocked over backwards because the force of it knocked me on my back. And I'm sitting there trying to, with pieces of my poncho getting in the way, and I'm choking on all the smoke from this. And it was crazy, but it was almost comical what was going on. And I was scared to death. And I was shaking so much I couldn't get the clip, flipping the clip over to get the other 30 rounds in to the gun. And so I just kind of laid on the deck and watched all this stuff and yelling and screaming going on. And so what had happened was a Viet Cong or North Vietnamese Army squad had come in to ambush our boat and probably try and take it. And unbeknownst to us, there was a South Vietnamese Army group that was assigned to counter ambush if that happened, because they probably figured. So this big firefight was going on and, several people died. I couldn't see because it was pitch black. And we actually were able to pull off the sandbar when the tide got a little higher and get out of there before it even got light. But this big firefight and people died right probably 10 feet away from me. And I couldn't even see what was going on. Oh, it was crazy.
That's a very intense story.
Yeah. So anyway, there were a number of things like that that happened over there.
How long were you stationed?
I was over there for 18 months. And I extended my tour. The duty assignment was 12 months. And I extended my tour over there because they would give you a cash reward. They would give you 30 days leave and fly you anywhere in the world that you wanted to go. And they would say, well, when you come back, what kind of job would you? Well, I said, I want to be in the fire department at Da Nang. I said, I've got the training and I know some of the guys. I had made friends with some of the guys that worked in the fire department because they took care. They had a 60-man fire department with three stations stationed around Da Nang area. Taking care of the bases, the fire protection of the base, and they were really busy. There's, one, you're in a war zone, but two, you've got all these young kids, doing all kinds of jobs that they really weren't trained properly for, and so there were always accidents and fires and things like that. And then when the enemy would attack with rockets and stuff, everything would be on fire.
So you extended your time
to be in the fire department.
So you're 19 when you finally leave the military?
I was 20.
20. And where did you go from there?
So I came to, while I was in Vietnam, I got a hold of a Lovejoy's college guide, and I'm coming back to San Francisco. I want to...
You know this.
Oh, yeah. That was my goal. I'm coming back to San Francisco, and I looked at colleges around the area, and the only one I could find was College of Marin that offered fire sciences. And so I registered for College of Marin, got accepted while I was still in Vietnam, and I got back on August 21st of 1968, and classes started in September 3rd. So I had just that short, brief period of time. I got discharged at Treasure Island, even though I was supposed to get discharged at Long Beach. And I just went, well, I don't have enough time. So I just reported to Treasure Island, and they took, you know, you idiot, you're supposed to be at Long Beach. And I knew they wouldn't turn around and send me back. So I got discharged. In 3 days, I was out of the service. Got on a Greyhound bus at the 7th Street Greyhound bus station in San Francisco, came up to Marin County, got off in Greenbrae, and there was a bowling alley in Greenbrae at the time.
Greenbrae
Lanes, yep. So the bus would stop there. I got off. Everything I owned was in a half a sea bag. Started walking towards College of Marin and decided, you know what, this is kind of a nice place right along Quarter Madera Creek right there. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to camp here for a while until I get a place to live. And so I stashed the stuff in the bushes, which, you know, it's all houses there now, but it was, you know, just all marshland at the time. And it was August, September, October. I was homeless. I was living there, going to College of Marin, and just living by the creek and happy as could be that I was out of the military. You know, I did little part jobs and stuff, but I didn't have any money, and it was hard to, nobody wanted to rent to a Vietnam veteran. And
because you were basically the enemy at that point, because it was anti-Vietnam over here.
It was very anti-Vietnam.
So if you'd been in the military, you were the sellout, I guess.
And when I was going to the college, I was wearing this fatigue jacket that it was my dad's in the Korean War, and he gave it to me. He actually had it in World War II, and then wore it in the Korean War. And then I wore it when I was in Vietnam. It was an old field jacket. And I still have that field jacket. I wear it every Veterans Day.
And your hair was probably short in a time where there was a lot of long hair.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, veterans stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yes.
So I'm going to College of Marin. Don't know anybody. I'm getting treated pretty poorly because I'm wearing this fatigue jacket and they knew I was a veteran. So people just kind of shunned you. You were a pariah. Mm-hmm. I remember one episode where this gal came up to me and big smile and said, "Oh, are you a veteran?" I said, "Yeah." She spit big wad right in my face and started swearing at me and calling me a baby killer and stuff. And I just went, wow. it was tough enough not knowing anybody, but to have something like that happen. So it kind of upset me. But then the second week of school, I ran into a guy named Greg Rossoff, who was a Marine that I had met in Vietnam. And the two of us, where he was on R&R and I was working for the fire department at the time. And so I had every fourth day off, which was unheard of in a war zone. And I would go down to China Beach and surf. And they had a bar there. It was an R&R center for the Marines. And anyway, I ran into Greg there and he was arguing with me about how great the Marines were. And I was telling him, oh, Navy's better. And I just remember that, but I recognized him at College of Marin. We ran into him and we became best friends. And Greg became a police officer for Corte Madera and became a firefighter. And he was best man at my wedding. He introduced me to my wife. So it was...
And this is what year that you met your wife?
So my wife I met in 1972. Actually had her in a class, a psychology class at College of Marin. And I thought, oh, she's kind of cute. I'd kind of like to get to know her. And we were breaking up into groups of four to work on a project in the psych class together. And I kind of made sure I was in her group. And so she just...
I guess she kind of...
She dropped the class. So I was set up on a blind date. And we got married a year from the day we met. And that was 1973. And we have two beautiful girls. Oh, my wife's name is Colleen. It was Colleen Coleman. And when I showed up on the blind date to meet Colleen, first thing I went, wow, I know you. You're the gal from the cycle. And George, what are you doing here? It turns out George, her brother, was good friends with me, and we shared supplies in a photography class at the college.
Oh,
and,
so you and had we used to pal around. Vouch for you.
And, well, no, I went, George, what are you doing here? And he goes, well, these are my sisters. He had three sisters. He never told me he had three sisters. And he says, with good reason.
So anyway. So you have two children with Colleen, your children's names?
They're Jennifer and Tammy. And Tammy is named after Mount Tamalpais. So I wanted to call her Tamalpais Williams, and my wife said, yeah, no.
So you really had an affinity for Mount Tamalpais.
I did. And so when I was going to college in Marin, that first year was hard, and I got taken in by Larkspur Fire Department because one of the professors, Bill Lillis, was assistant chief of Larkspur Fire. He was one of my professors, and somebody said, you know, Pat's homeless. He's living down by the creek. And Bill had been in the Marine Corps in the Korean War, and he pulled me aside after class one night and said, what's this I hear about you living by the creek? And I said, yes, no big deal. And he said, well, what are you doing for bathroom facilities needing? And he said, I manage, I'm doing fine, sir. And I use the shower and facilities at the college, at the gym. It's not a big deal. And he goes, get your stuff and bring it into the fire station there in Greenbrae. He said, I've got a bed for you in a locker. And he said, you have to work every Sunday at the downtown fire station opposite St. Patrick's Church there. And pull a shift every Sunday and for free in exchange for your room and board or your room and locker. And I said, well, thank you. Yeah, it sounds great to me. And it was great because I'd been trying to find a place to live and tried to get a job as a doing child care. You know, I figured, I'm the oldest of eight kids. I can do child care and did a little part-time job, but nobody wanted to hire a veteran. Nobody wanted to rent to a veteran. Mm-hmm. So it worked out for me. The stars were in alignment and it fell in. And so after spending that winter at the fire station there and had a lot of fun and I think it was an asset to the fire department there. I helped them out a lot. Bill said, why don't you apply for the fire lookout job? They're looking for a fire lookout.
I have to ask.
Yes.
You told me earlier in the interview that you looked across the bay to the mountain and you thought to yourself, you're going to hike to the top of that mountain sometime.
Yep.
Did you do that before you became a fireman?
I did that when I got into the Larkspur Fire Department. There was a guy there, I can't think of his name now, but anyway, he later became a San Francisco firefighter. But I had told him, I said, well, let's do it. So we hiked straight out of Baltimore Canyon, straight up the mountain.
Yeah.
And I have some photographs taken that he took of me just peeking right at the fire lookout.
Yeah.
Yeah. And who knew that, that next summer I would be the fire lookout up there.
So you were the fire lookout. So, how those of us down below wonder what it must be like to be a fire lookout.
It was amazing. I couldn't believe my luck. And it wasn't just luck. I camped out and Chief Louis Bloom was the county fire chief at that time. And I would be in his office every morning when he showed up for work. I'd be sitting in the right outside of his office waiting for him to make a decision on who they were going to have for lookout. And after the third day, he comes in and he starts swearing. He goes, somebody give this idiot the keys to the fire lookout and get him out of my office. And so, I wound up going up there. And I lived there from May 15th to October 31st of 1969. And
so
I was in heaven.
Tell me, though, this is 69. I remember those times. There was a lot of mischief going on outside.
Well, it was the...
There was drugs and rock and roll.
Yep, they were...
Free love.
They had the big concerts over here at the Mountain Theater. And where all the big bands were playing. And
I interviewed Marty Bell, and he described it as one of the highlights of his life.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I could hear the music from Mount Tam, but, I couldn't leave the lookout during the day, but I could hear the music from the fire lookout. And I got a lot of the fallout, people that were high on LSD.
Tell me what you saw. Give me a bird's eye
view. I'll give you one example. I left the door, and I was down I remember I was downstairs talking to this pretty young lady and...
At the lookout.
At the fire lookout, yeah. And I was down in front because people had asked for directions.
Sure.
And, you know, and I would hear people pointing to the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge and telling people that's the Golden Gate Bridge, and I would correct them. And so I got to meet a lot of really interesting people in the fire lookout, and I would talk to everybody, you know.
You're an affable fellow.
It was social, and I was looking to meet some people, you know, too, because I didn't really know a lot of people around
here. Slowly up there on the top.
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah. Well, I refer to myself as the fool on the hill, and my wife still does. So here I am on top of Mount Tamalpais in this incredibly beautiful environment. So that May, from that was the year they stopped backyard burning in Marin County. In fact, most of the Bay Area, it was the entire Bay Area, they had formed the Air Pollution District and banned out backyard burning. So May and June, you could, by 10 o'clock in the morning, you could hardly see anything because everybody's burning everything off before the ban took effect. So the air pollution was just terrible. So by noon, I mean, I could see off in the distance, but anything below Throckmorton Ridge, you couldn't see. It was just covered in brown smoke because everybody was doing their backyard burning to get rid of everything. And then July 1st, it took effect and the air magically cleared up because they
I can't believe they allowed burning that late in the season.
Yeah. July 1st was the final thing. And they I mean, it was a different world back then, too. And we didn't have the vegetation we have now, too. We did a good job of protecting the mountain, and now the vegetation has changed. So this will be my 50th year on Mount Tam.
Remember the time I came up here? You know, it's always nice as a hiker to come up to the West Point Inn. Mm-hmm. And if it's slow at the inn, you get an opportunity to sit and talk with the innkeepers and talk story, as they say. And
yep.
I remember you telling me this remarkable story about how you basically saved the West Point and you and your brother from burning down.
Well, we were mountain biking up here, and I did a lot of that. I became friends with a lot of people, the original mountain biker. Otis Guy and Joe Breeze were friends of mine, and Gary Fisher and...
Steve Potts, did you know Steve? Charlie Cunningham?
Charlie and Jackie. Of course I knew them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're old friends too.
Mm-hmm.
Otis was a new fireman there, and I was his captain, and you know, I really got into to mountain biking at that point because Otis was kind of a legend too.
Mm-hmm.
So, my brother and I were biking up here, and we came in, it was a hot September day, and the wind was blowing, it was coming out of the west, but it was blowing pretty hard. I came in, because they used to sell the lemonade in the kitchen here, and I didn't have good feelings about West Point, because at the time, when I was the fire lookout in 69, I came down here one foggy day, just on a hike, because there was no need for me to, top of the mountain was fogged in, and I wanted to come down and see what was down here. So I walked down here, and I came up on the deck, and there was a woman, she introduced herself as Pat. She said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm the fire lookout up on the mountain." I had my Marin County Fire lookout shirt on and my whole uniform on. And, I came up the steps and she goes, "You know somebody here?" And I said, "No." "Then get off our porch."
Ouch.
And I went, "But I just want to introduce myself. Get off our porch, you know."
And ours being...
So they ran the West Point Inn was run like a private club back then. You had to know somebody. And you had to have connections, and they actually had a little a box with black balls in it where if you got two black balls, then you couldn't be a member. And you had to be invited by a member to even be considered to be a member. So it was upright. There was a lawsuit that happened in the 80s that stopped all that from happening because Charlie Evans was involved in that. He was a past president of West Point, and they turned the West Point Inn around, and it operates much more friendly.
Charlie changed that rigid...
He filed a lawsuit and got it changed because he was part of the Tamalpa Runners, and he came up here, and he obviously got the same kind of treatment, and he said, that's not going to happen on my watch. And so Charlie got things changed up here. And so the West Point Inn now, it's on public land. needs to be done then. So anyway, I went back up to the Lookout and just went, well, the hell with them. And didn't think anything out, but I would stop in here and buy lemonade on my bike route. And we stopped in here and came in, and there was no innkeeper around, and there was smoke coming out of the kitchen. And that's where they had the supplies. We didn't have the Honor store like we do now. And I'm looking, and it's probably about 5 o'clock. The wind's blowing. And out of the corner of my eye, I see flame. And as I came up to the door, well, they had a propane refrigerator there. And the propane refrigerator had a flue that had carboned up, and the carbon had caught fire. And flames were impinging on the gas line and starting to roll on the ceiling. The paint was starting to burn on the ceiling. So we shut the gas off and quickly put the fire out. It wasn't a big fire. You know, it just basically burnt paint. But
15 minutes later.
Oh, 5 minutes later.
5 minutes.
Yeah, the building would have been beyond saving, I think. Yeah, it was just starting to roll. And it was just serendipity that two firefighters show up. And so I went down to Throckmorton. I said, you guys better get up there and check what's going. It was pre-cell phone days, you know, so I rode my bike down there and talked to the guys there that I knew. I think Pete Martin was one of them. And they came up and took a look at it. And I got a call from the West Point Inn and saying, we'd love to have you as a member. Thank you for saving the place. And so I became a member and raised funds.
Was the woman who was so unpleasant?
No.
She was gone?
No, she was gone. So I don't know what her last name was. I can find
out.
Pat something, yeah. And here I am, another Pat innkeeper up there. But hopefully I never treat anybody that way.
Not so far, so I've heard.
Well, a couple weeks ago I did yell and scream at some people and sent them down that were guests because they were having a little hookah party in the honeymoon cabin and set the fire alarm off. And when the alarm went off, of course, it automatically dispatches the fire department. And
well, a lot of people don't understand this, I think, but there's no smoking allowed on
there's
mountain.
No candles, no smoking anywhere on the mountain, no. Especially here at the West Point Inn.
So. Yes. So they were politely asked to leave. Did they know?
It wasn't very polite. I screamed and yelled at them and swore at them and said, get your ass out of here. And it was 8 o'clock at night, which was not a good thing because they were stoned. And I wound up intercepting them on the fire. And I said, come on back. We'll talk about this in the morning. I don't want you to go down. But there was one of them that didn't participate. And he said, don't worry. I've got Uber coming to pick these people up. And it's taken care of. But I told him, don't come back.
So you were on the top as a lookout man, which is such a romantic kind of a job, which was further, my vision of that, further cemented by Gary Yost's wonderful film, The Day in the Life of the Lookout.
Well, I'm the one that introduced Gary to the lookout.
Let's talk about that.
I met Gary on the deck here, and just talking. He seemed like a personable guy, and we were chit-chatting, and I asked him what he did, and he says, well, I do a lot of work with the Waldorf School. He said, I'm pretty much retired, and he said, wow, you're pretty young to be retired. And he goes, yeah, I did well, and I think it was Atari or Autodesk.
Yeah,
it was whatever firm he was.
Computer.
Yeah, it's a computer thing. Anyway, so he was creative in photography and filmmaking and things, and I said, well, I am too. I really enjoy doing that kind of thing. And so we hit it off. And somehow the topic of the fire lookout came up, and I said, well, if you're interested, I said, I'm one of the trainers up there, and it's all volunteer now. Sandy Ross, who lives in Mill Valley,
yes,
and
I. She's my neighbor.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. Sandy and I started the whole volunteer program because after they stopped paying lookouts, the lookout went dormant, and
yes.
We got the whole thing going.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was one of the original trainers, and I told Gary, I said, yeah, I think you'd enjoy it, Gary. It's amazing. It the experiences you'll have up there, you'll remember the rest of your life. I told him about a night in 1969 when I was in the fire lookout, and the fog came in and stopped at the railing of the fire lookout. I was above it, and it was dead calm. There was a full moon. And it was like I could step off the deck and walk off. I'm the only person in the entire Bay Area that is above the fog, unless you're in an airplane. And it just was dead calm, dead still, dead quiet. You could hear nothing because the fog was really thick. And the stars were just, with a full moon, you could still see all these bright stars, and the clouds were just lit up like, almost like daylight. It was all silver. Uh-huh. And it was like you could step off and walk over to Mount Diablo. Because mm-hmm. Mount Diablo was the next thing.
That you could see picking its head up above the clouds.
You
could
see it picking it. Mm-hmm. It's quite a bit higher than Mount Tam.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, Gary became a fire lookout up there, and he did that wonderful video of Day in the Life of a Lookout.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a really nice job with that. And
he really did.
It kind of kicked off Gary's career.
Yes, he really did.
He became
still
famous
with
that.
Still one of my favorite films.
It's still one of my favorites, yeah. In fact, right after he did it, he gave me one of the original Blu-ray copies of it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's one of my treasures. And
I cry
Gary's still
every
a good
time.
Friend.
Yeah, I cry every time I watch that film.
Yeah.
Because it really, he captures it. He's yep. good.
It does. It does capture the way I felt up there. And it captured that experience I just told you about, the magic of the clouds.
What other things, before we move away from the lookout, because I'm absolutely fascinated by this,
well,
what other things would you have seen up there?
So one interesting story was, I used to invite people, because I was off duty. As soon as the sun went down, I was off duty, and I could have a glass of wine.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would pop open a bottle of wine as the sun's going down, and I would kind of look around and trying to meet, and there was a couple down there that, you know, could have been a little less, not quite as old as my parents, but, and they just seemed to be very much in love and stuff. And I said, hey, would you guys like to have a glass of wine up in the fire lookout? Well, we weren't supposed to invite people in, but I did. And so they came up and had a glass of wine, and they were just thrilled that I did this. And we chatted, and they said, do you have a girlfriend? And I said, no. I said, I've not had good luck with meeting girls here as a Vietnam veteran and stuff. And they, well, we'd love for our daughter to meet you. And I said,
awkward.
Yeah, it was a little awkward. So the next weekend, I see this beautiful woman. I kind of got my binoculars out. I'm looking, and the parking lot's kind of full. And I see this woman getting out of a Volkswagen van. And I could tell she was a beautiful woman all the way from the fire lookout. And I see her walking up the trail, and she's carrying a box. And I'm going, whoa, wouldn't that be great if that was the daughter that they were talking about? But she comes up and knocks on the fire lookout door. And she said, hi, you treated my parents really nice up here last week, and I baked you this cake.
Like,
so
thank
I invited
you, God.
Her in, and we wound up dating. In fact, we almost got married for a couple of years. But, I mean, we just hit it off right away.
Oh, seriously, Pat.
Yeah.
A really cute yeah. guy in the fire lookout on the top of the world.
Well.
That has a certain allure.
Yeah. Well, she was amazing. She loved to rock climb and dance and things like that. So I wound up getting people to cover at the fire lookout for me. Mm-hmm. I would usually only come down once every 2 weeks, get supplies at Mill Valley Market, and then go back up to the fire lookout. So I decided, you know, I need to have some time off. And she was in the College of Arts in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
And she was into being an artist. So her name was Leanna,
yes.
Leanna Pinkston.
Mm-hmm.
And I always wondered what happened to her. But anyway.
Well, that was her.
Yeah, we dated. We climbed a number of peaks in the Sierra. She taught me rock climbing, and her parents were really into it, too. And we had quite the romance. And it broke off. She was a little too wild for me. So, mm-hmm. That was one person that I met up there. There was another time I had somebody, I was downstairs talking to somebody, and a guy came up, and he snuck in behind me, got up in the lookout, and I went upstairs, and here is a body in my bed with the covers pulled over the
Whoa.
Head. I'm going, what the heck? And I pull back the covers, and here's this guy, and he's just stoned out of his mind, laying in my bed. I said, you know, come on, get up. And it was hard to get him, and I had to help him down the stairs. He was so intoxicated. And so I went down and locked the door, and I went, oh, man. And that happened a number of times where people, they'd be doing drugs. And I said, you can't smoke up here. You know, I was always telling people, I still, to this day.
Well, I think time before last when I was up here, we were up at the deck, and we could see a guy smoking over by the picnic table.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's
and
almost
he argued it. Remember?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I do remember it. Yep. So I'm always Mr. fire marshal pad up here.
Yeah. How about any physical phenomenon besides the amazing pausing fog, which I don't think I'll ever forget that image?
There were some interesting things that happened. There was something that flew across the sky. I don't know what it was, but it was below the lookout, and it was moving at supersonic speed, but there was no sound to it. It was very, very odd. I don't know whether it was a meteorite or what, but as it went shooting by, and I'm talking about, I happened to catch it out of the eye coming from north to south on the bay, and I just happened to be looking out towards Hamilton Field, and I saw this thing just going faster than any aircraft.
Big, little?
It was just a streak.
Uh-huh.
But it was moving at a horizontal, probably Mount Tam is at 2571, and this was probably maybe 2,500 foot. Mm-hmm. And it was right over the bay, and it kind of just disappeared over the Bay Bridge. But as it came, and we're talking split second here, you know, from the time I saw it until it was over the Bay Bridge was maybe a second. But as it passed the lookout, I had a Pyrex dish sitting there, and the dish just exploded all over the lookout at the moment that it came by. So I don't know, but there was no sound. That's the weird thing. There was absolutely no sound. And I actually had a friend of mine, it was Greg Rossoff, who I talked about earlier. It was his brother, Michael, who lives down in Mill Valley. And he was up in the fire lookout with me. And he just freaked when that happened. And none of us, we didn't know what it was. Still to this day, I don't know what it was. It was a really strange phenomenon. But yeah, that was pretty memorable. And then there was a time, it was September 17th, because somebody had actually did a fact check on my story and pulled up the sheriff's records, Marin County Sheriff's records, and did some background on it here. And that was just recently. But there was a guy that was covering the fire lookout for me when I was down getting supplies. His father worked for the water district. His name was Dale Walsh. And he would come up and cover the lookout. And then I was coming back up, and it had rained that night. And I got up there, and there was a MG with a top down in the parking lot. And, oh, some poor guy or gal's car broke down. They left, and they couldn't get the top up or something. But, you know, those were me. I thought it was a little odd. And it had some strange, I remember it had a grill that it was either gold-plated or bronze-plated, which is just not characteristic of an MG. But it was a beautiful car, and I kind of looked at it and went, wow, that's a shame. It's all wet. And I'm walking up, and Dale is walking back down. He sees me pulling in park, and I'm hiking up with all my groceries and stuff. And I said, so how'd it go? And he goes, well, there's a guy up there, and he wants to come in the lookout. And he was all wet, and he just seemed really strange. And I went, oh, great. And I said, you locked the lookout? And he goes, no. And I went, oh. So, of course, I get up to the lookout, and this guy's inside the lookout. And he's wet. He's wearing a tweed jacket, almost like a Scottish smoking jacket. He had horn-rimmed glasses, and he was about a foot shorter than me. I remember that he was fairly short. And I said, you know, you were told you weren't supposed to go on the lookout, and you came in. I said, you know, well, he said, I'm cold, and, you know, and he was babbling on. And I said, is that your car down there? And he goes, yeah, you know, but he was kind of talking nonsense is the best way to describe it. I said, look, I'll make you a cup of tea and then you have to leave. I've got work to do. And so I put the teapot on, and this guy's talking about his car and his dipstick in his car. And I just, yeah, this guy's a dipstick. I need to get him out of here. And I'm looking out the window. His back is to me. And I can see his reflection in the window as I'm over the stove trying to get the water to heat up. You know what they say about a watched pot never boils. Mm-hmm. This time I was trying to get it to boil by pressing it down on the stove. And he's a little pause in his conversation. And I can see his reflection. And he's got something in his hand. And he's got it up like he's going to plunge it into my back. Well, I just grabbed the teapot, swung around, and whacked him with the teapot. And the hot water, you know, spilled out on him, and I don't think he got burned because he was already wet and cold. But we tussled a little bit, and I could see he had a long, you know, sharp thing, and I just assumed that it was the dipstick out of his MG that he had. But I thought, this is just bizarre. You know, this guy just is trying to stab me, and we you know, wrestle a little bit, and he ran down the stairs, and I followed him down, and he ran out, and I locked the door, and then I could see him start MG and drive away. And of course, this happened after a number of the things, like the guy sleeping in the bed. I just went, threw my hands up, and went, wow, the door's locked. Didn't think anything of it, but I was listening to KGO radio, the news, and right at noon that came on it of a flash, they found a woman stabbed to death in Lake Berryessa, and she'd been stabbed with an ice pick like instrument multiple times, and it was the Zodiac, and he had left his calling card, you know, because he used to brag about his, he would leave a calling card. And I'm listening to this news story, and the hair on the back of my neck and arms just stood straight up, and I went, that guy just tried to stab me with an ice pick like instrument. So I called the sheriff and made a report on it. And of course they said, well, what do you want us to do? That was, you know, 3-4 hours ago. And I said, well,
That
very same day. So I, and the woman that was murdered, they said it probably happened within the last 48 hours. And I was thinking, I wonder if this could be the same guy, you know? So anyway, I gave a description to him. I never heard back from anybody on it. But it's still kind of, I've never read any of the Zodiac books or gone to any of the movies. It just kind of, it still kind of creeps me out.
Well, there has been, I've been hiking this mountain for a very long time, mm-hmm. since the 70s. And I remember the time of the hillside killer.
Yeah.
The trailside killer.
David Carpenter.
And, you know, at the time, hiking is such a draw and you think, what are the chances, but
yeah,
people who thought that very thing were killed on the trails.
Yeah, I was innkeeping up here at the time. We operated a little differently back then, but I was innkeeping at West Point Inn, and when all that was going on, and boy, it just, the hike, it, people, it, there was nobody, you didn't see anybody on the mountain when that happened. Julie Alderson, who I knew, was one of those that was murdered. I think it was, if I remember correctly, I think it was on the Matt Davis Trail. It was down below the,
oh dear, really?
The inn here. And yeah, he ambushed her and killed her. And she was a really, had a real promising career. Her father was a physician, lived out in Sleepy Hollow. And I had started a JC chapter in Corte Madera, and both her and her brother were members of that JC chapter, mm-hmm. Junior Chamber of Commerce.
Mm-hmm. How about animals? Have you seen any bizarre animal behavior in your time here on the mountain?
I have never seen a mountain lion.
Oh, really?
And it really kind of, I know they're around here. I've seen the footprints. I had an encounter one time where, when I first started as a paid innkeeper up here 12 years ago, I was going up to check the water tank just around sunset, and usually I do it in the morning. I just got busy that day, and I think I got to get up and add chlorine to the tank. So I got my stuff together, and as I was locking the back door to the inn, I heard this awful sound, you know, like a scream, but it wasn't a scream. And I thought, what the heck was that? And okay. I walk around the, just go around the bend here, right on the fire road, right opposite cabin 4. And here is a huge buck going through its death throes,
yes.
And just starting to bleed out. And it had a big bite mark on its neck and had been eviscerated. And I went, wow, that's classic mountain lion.
Yes.
And so now, once again, I'm getting that hair on the back of my neck standing up. And I know that mountain lion is looking at me. I don't see it. I just kind of did a little glance around. I didn't see it. But they don't leave their prey, and they guard it religiously. And this had just happened. So I got to the edge of the fire, looked at as far over as I could, and just kept walking to the water tank like nothing had happened. Because if I had stopped, that mountain lion probably would have defended its prey. So I just kept going, and I got up there, and I did the water tank, and I'm thinking, I got to go back down. How am I going to, you know, it's too dark to go back the Miller Trail. And I don't have a light on me, so I came back down the fire road and just
thunk,
looking
thunk
everywhere. Yeah. So I get to where the deer was, and it's gone.
Yes.
There's big pool of blood there, and there's a trail of blood going right up that bank, which is almost, you know, about 80% grade going straight up that bank. And it had drugged that deer that I'd estimate about 150 pounds minimum. drug that deer straight up that bank. That's a powerful animal that can do that. I found the carcass up where we have our solar panels now. There was nothing back there.
Yes.
And I found the carcass about a month later back there when it was picked dry.
Yep, I've seen about half a dozen sightings.
Of mountain lion?
Yes, yeah. Some right in front of me.
Yeah.
And I have seen carcasses freshly killed, completely cleaned to the bone. Nothing left.
Yep.
Overnight.
They don't waste anything.
No, they do not.
And anything they leave over, the coyotes and the raccoons. So,
yeah.
We have raccoons up here, which we haven't had for a long time. We've got one last night knocked over the garbage can before I could get in. I bring them in at night. And 9:30 last night, I heard crash, boom, bang, and I came out there. And, I didn't see them, but their little wet footprints were there. And they garbage all over the deck.
Work. When did you start your job as an innkeeper?
So I became a member of the West Point Inn in 1989. And the way they operated in those days was you became a weekend host. You got trained after you were a member for a year and you were desired to, they trained you to be a host and you could come up and stay at the inn for free and run it from Friday afternoon until Sunday morning. So Friday and Saturday nights, and you kind of ran the inn. And then they had a paid innkeeper that was up here from Tuesday morning until Friday afternoon. And so you would relieve him. And he was, he was basically your supervisor. He'd tell you what needed to be done. And so you ran the inn. It was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed doing it. And I was working as a firefighter and stuff. So I did it whenever I could. And then became friends with the innkeepers. At the time, it was a kid, Daniel Morowitz. And when he needed relief, I'd fill in for him. And
Were you paid as your fill-in position?
No, I would volunteer to do that. So most people want to be paid, but I had a good job at the fire department, and I loved being up here. So, I'd come up and work for a week, and I went, oh, this is a lot of fun.
What are the duties of an innkeeper?
It's a lot. I mean, keeping the place safe is number one. Protecting it from fire is what we consider number one. And so in 12 years ago, they asked me, they had a young couple up here and they weren't working out, and they asked me to come up and run the inn while they had to go through an eviction process to get them out. And so I stayed up in the main part of the inn in one of the rooms and ran the inn for pretty much the whole month of December in 2007. And they wanted me to be the permanent innkeeper up here. And I said, no, I've got a life down the mountain, but hey, I got an idea. What if I got a couple of my retired fire buddies to help me out? We do a job share thing. And they said, well, give us something in writing. So I went to the board and made the presentation. They decided to try it out for 6 months. And two of the board members wanted to do it also. So we started out with four of us, two retired firefighters, myself, Jim McElrath, and Carolyn Thurm, and Ed Poser. We started this thing, and I don't think the board will ever go back. It worked out really well, and so they try and hire retired firefighters. I'm the last retired firefighter, and we have three San Francisco firefighters that are currently
working. And their names?
Jennifer Green, Carl Jorgensen, and Craig Gordon, and they're all relatively new. Carl's been here for a couple of years, but he's only worked a few shifts. They're still working full times as firefighters and paramedics in the city, so it's hard for them to do it. But they're turning out well. And there's another firefighter who lives in Mill Valley, who's been I think he was a chief officer in Daly City, who is retiring now, and I've got his name, and I'm going to interview him to see if he's interested in being an innkeeper.
So you keep the perimeter clear from fire?
We try and maintain a minimum of a 200-foot perimeter around the inn. And I raised funds, $100,000, when I first became a member to put a sprinkler system in here. And to show I was earnest, I dug a trench 2 feet deep all through this parking lot.
This is not such easy stuff to dig a trench into.
Yeah, it's not. But, it was good labor. And ran a line out to the fire line. We have a separate fire line from our water line that supplies water to the inn. So we've got a pretty good water system. And so we have 98 sprinkler heads in the inn now. They put a commercial system in, which cost $100,000. And most of it was from one of our old members who was a wealthy man. And I pulled his arm way up behind his back until he went up all in and coughed up the money.
Thank you. And how about, so there's fire prevention. Certainly your training as a fireman has got to help with yep. injuries and right. health issues that may yep. come up as, you know, as can. I'm sure more than one person has ridden their bike right up to here
yep.
to the West Point Inn to have their heart attack or...
Yep. Oh, yeah. There's... I insisted when I came up here, I had two demands. One was that we have an AED and a good first aid kit up here, which mm-hmm. the board agreed to. Mm-hmm. And the second was that they not replace the cat that had passed away, because I'm highly allergic to cats, mm-hmm. as a lot of people are. And
I can't imagine a cat would even last that long up here at the end.
Well, we've had a number of cats, and I loved them. I really like cats. I'm just allergic to them. Uh-huh. But the cats also are hard on the environment up here. Uh-huh. You know, they kill lizards and birds and what have you. But the cats we had, I mean, they died of old age and illnesses.
Really, no coyotes took them for us now.
They were smarter than that. We used to leave one of the windows up by the fire escape in room 7 open. And... you had asked me earlier about if I'd ever seen a ghost up here. Well, I heard a ghost. So the year I started up here, my wife Colleen and I were sleeping in room 7, because that's the room I was running the inn. And we were in bed one night, and Tink, who had been the previous cat, had passed away about a month before and was just buried just down by the head of the Nora Trail. Mm-hmm. So... I heard a meow, and I went, I got another cat up here. And I woke up, I looked at Colleen and said, "Did you hear that?" And he goes, "Yeah." And I didn't hear anything, so I rolled up and went back, and I heard it again. What the heck? So I got up, went out on the fire escape and looked, you know, on the roof and see if I could see a cat around, and I saw nothing. It was just quiet, nothing. So I went back to bed. Another 5 minutes goes by, and I hear a meow again. So I went, okay, this has got to be Tink's ghost. So I open up the window, because Tink, you know, that was would throw a fit if that window was ever closed. So I opened the window, and I never heard another meow. But about 2 weeks later, Jennifer Barkley, who is one of our people up here, she's been a member for a long time. You know Jennifer.
Yes, she does a lot.
So Jennifer... was up here, and she was sleeping on the couch. I think the inn was full, and anyway, she was sleeping on the couch. And she woke up and saw Tink walking into the, this is another month later, so it's 2 months after Tink had passed away, and saw Tink walking from the parlor into the members' lounge and then disappear into just was an aberration, just disappeared. I said, well, you're probably dreaming, but I thought, interesting coincidence here.
So, oh, how about, but any other ghosts?
So
ghosts of previous innkeepers or?
So there's been the piano being played, and I hear this incredible piano music, and a number of past board members said, oh yeah, that is, forgot her name, but was one of the previous board presidents, and she had passed away, and she liked to play the piano, was a good piano player, and that's it. Oh, yeah, because other people had heard that, too.
So that just randomly they'd be up in the room and hear the piano?
Yeah, you'd hear the piano going. Somebody's playing the piano, you come down, and just as you, before you get into the room, it stops, and there's nobody here. There's nobody there. So, but there have been a number of times where people have come in and play the piano, and I hear it, and I always go to see who's playing it, and... there's a doctor, a plastic surgeon, pretty famous plastic surgeon from Larkspur, who comes up, he's an incredible piano player. So I tell him, anytime you're up here, you come in and play it. But he was playing it one time, and it stopped, and I thought, oh no, it's the piano ghost again. And it turned out it was him. So, and it could have been him in the past.
So let's talk some more, so people can understand further about the responsibilities of the innkeeper.
Okay.
You've got the fire, you've got to, what else?
Well, you've got to make
clean? Do you clean it?
Yeah. That's one of the biggest jobs, is keeping this place clean. It's an old building built in 1904, and it's a lot of work to maintain it. For instance, after I'm finished talking with you today, I've got to go pull a toilet up in one of the bathrooms out there because it's leaking badly, mm-hmm. and put a new wax seal in and put it back down again. And it's a You know, it's all every day there is something broken or something needs to be fixed. And we're completely off grid up here. So we've got a solar system, a septic system, a water system that we maintain. It's a lot of work. You work from 7 in the morning until 11 at night.
Every day that you're here. Yeah. And yet you'd look at this and think, this is the greatest.
It is the greatest. You have to like to work. Yes. If you want to be an innkeeper, you have to like to work.
And I should think
because if you don't like to work, you're not going to last very well. And you have to like people because this is a people job. Your job is greeting people, recruiting members, telling people about the history of the mountain and telling stories. And of course, I like to elaborate and make up some of the ghost stories that I do, and I usually base it on fact. We have a cabin built by a man named Washington Dodge.
Let's close this with, I want to close that story with, okay. With your interview with that story.
Okay. Because
I've witnessed you telling the story, and it's so funny, and it seems like it's totally true, but I think it's
partially
one of the
true.
Tall tales. But so you've got, how about the bedding situation here? People need to bring their bedding.
So when you stay at the West Point Inn, we ask people to bring sheets and pillowcases to fit a double bed because mm-hmm. our beds are almost all doubles, a few singles, and one queen. So we do rent sheets out for $20, but it's a hassle for us to pack that all down the mountain. But we keep that for people that are traveling.
So I see there's sheets on some of the beds.
Yeah, well, there's not supposed to be, but we have mattress pads and, you know,
yes.
Pillow covers and stuff, but we want people to bring their own. Part of it is to prevent bed bugs from spreading, which, mm-hmm. knock on wood, we haven't had happen up here yet.
Mm-hmm.
But most hotels and inns have had bed bug problems in the past. We've never had that up here.
And other duties. Let's just get that on the table.
Yeah. So making sure that the guests are, we turn the lights out at night. Our lighting system is propane, which is a dangerous gas, and nobody can touch that except for the innkeepers.
Mm-hmm.
Just making sure people are staying safe. A lot of parties up here. People
get
drunk.
I was going to ask, how about your drunken stories?
Oh, there are plenty of those. Yeah, people come up. It's usually the 40th and 50th birthday parties where I always kind of go, oh, this is going to be a long night, and it usually is. But yeah, no, I've had to call search and rescue. There was one night, it was a 50th birthday party from this woman from Sacramento. And she was a school teacher and her husband was a pilot for one of the local airlines. And anyway, he had way too much to drink and passed out. They were staying in room one. And he was a very large guy and she went up to wake him up. She couldn't wake him up. So she decided, you know, she's going to go home. Drive back to Sacramento. And so she leaves. And so I had given them a little extra time. Usually I turn the lights out, but they had the entire inn rented out with their friends. And there was probably 25.
She was going to leave the inn with all of her friends and everything because there was no room for her on the bed?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, she'd been drinking. Everybody had been drinking a lot. And I had gone up and taken a little bit of a nap because I was tired. And I woke up and it was 11 o'clock. And I went, oh, I got to go down and get these people in bed. So I came back down. They said, well, we got a problem. This woman had wandered away, and I went down looking for her. And so I hiked down by our septic leach field down here, and I had a flashlight in my hand, but I didn't have it on, and I was just calling out her name, and I came down, and all of a sudden something hit my leg really hard. And I'm going, what the heck? So I turn on the flashlight, and I see this coyote running away from me. A pretty good clip. I take the light, and I've got all these eyes looking at me.
Oh.
And so I went, oh, this is not good. So I went back up to the inn. I yelled, and of course they, you know, scattered. But it was a moonless night, and I didn't see them. And they had surrounded me, and one of the rangers, water ranger, said, you are lucky, he said, because that's how they take down a deer. They'll knock the front legs off the deer, and when the deer hits the ground, they'll pounce, you know. And so I dodged a bullet there. So anyway, I went back up, called search and rescue, and said, we got a problem, got a woman missing up here. And they found her at 3 o'clock in the morning on Indian Fire Trail over above Kent Woodlands.
Oh, wow.
She thought she was walking back to Bootjack or Pantol.
Oh.
And she'd gone
the
wrong
way. Did
she
think she was going down Old Stagecoach?
Yeah, she thought she was on Old Stage and she was going down railroad. And got on the Hukuiku and went all the way around the mountain.
Oh, my God.
And then somebody woke up her husband, and he comes down, And he's got nothing but flip-flops and a pair of boxer shorts on. And he's, well, you know, pretty drunk. I can hear him crashing down the staircase. And he comes out, and I said, no, you can't. And so now this guy wants to fight me. And he's about my size and about 100 pounds more. And I said, I'm not going to fight you. He's belligerent. And I said, you can't. You're not in a state to go looking for your wife. We've got people looking for her. And he just pushes me aside, and he heads down. And I said, fine. I just got on the phone, called the sheriff, and said, hey, we got another one. And they picked him up down at the gate, down on Old Stage Road. And
Have you ever had to deliver a baby up here?
No, we've come close. I had a guest this last year who was up here, and she was more than 9 months pregnant. And I went and made sure the OB kit that we've got up here was ready to go. And 2 days later, she delivered. So, and the baby's been back up here to the end. So,
how about heart attacks?
We've had a number of people have heart attacks, and that AED that I had, this was a situation where this guy should not have made it. Somebody came up, I was talking to one of our board members' husbands, who I didn't know his husband, he was using his computer on the deck, and nobody was around, but people were starting to come up, and our board was having a board retreat inside the inn, and I went up and I said, sir, you can't use your laptop on the deck here. And he goes, oh, well, I'm a doctor and I'm trying to get some research. And I said, well, I that's fine, but you just can't do it on the deck here. I said, you can go down below here if you want. Well, my wife's one of the new board members. And I went, oh, okay. So I started talking to him. Somebody came up the stairs and said, hey, the mountain play had been going on that day. And he goes, hey, there's some guy down here that he collapsed when I came up on my mountain bike and I sat down and ate one of those foot-long Subway sandwiches, and he's just been laying there the whole time. And I thought he was drunk, but I'm not so sure now. So I said, oh, okay. So I went down and took a look at him, and he was blue as could be. And I looked at him and went, oh, no, this is not good. And I asked the guy, how long do you think you were sitting there? And he said, about 10 minutes. And so I hollered up. The board had taken a break, and I could see him out on the deck. And I hollered to one of them to bring the AED down and somebody else bring the medical kit down.
So for those that don't know what that is, that's the defibrillator.
Automatic defibrillator, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so they brought the defibrillator down and I hooked him up. And I actually physically picked him up and threw him on top of the picnic table down there, because it made it a lot easier to do CPR on him. Mm-hmm. And I'd started CPR and had CPR going for at least a minute before they brought the AED down. And I shocked him a number of times, and I talked to him, and I was violating some of the protocol. I was a national instructor trainer in CPR, so I've got a lot of experience in teaching and performing it all my years in the fire department. Well, it was determined, he came back. And when he came back, it was like I saw a ghost. And I had an audience, because the mountain play had broken out. There had to be 200 people standing around watching this whole thing. I was oblivious to it at the time because my focus was on this man that, it turns out he's one of my neighbors. He lives in Larkspur, and he was 60 years old, and that happened 7 years ago, I guess. And he's doing fine. And, you know, talking to him later, I thought he had passed away. I figured he's not going to make it. He's got too much brain damage because he was documented because of this guy witnessing him fall. He was what we call a witnessed arrest. And the estimate was it was over 10 minutes before he came up, got me, and I started CPR. And usually 10 minutes, your chance of surviving is zero. The only thing I can think of, he was probably in ventricular fibrillation, and mm-hmm. his head was downhill, flow. And he had enough blood flowing to his brain.
To his brain, right. So,
anyway, long story, I came up, and they helped the medics down at Throckmorton Ridge were busy on another call at Pantol, and so I had to wait for an ambulance all the way from Mill Valley to get up here. And the state park ranger showed up, and luckily Roberto, mm-hmm. and Roberto had oxygen, so I put oxygen on him, and Roberto helped me. And anyway, he came back and was very combative, and I figured, you know, he's probably got serious brain damage. So,
but not unusual for someone being.
Oh no! I mean, the chance of survival.
But combative behavior.
Combative behaviors are usually mm-hmm. a sign of severe brain damage. So they hauled him away in the ambulance, and they took our AED with us. And I went back down to the hospital to pick up the AED, and and figure, you know, I've got some contacts down there from my fire department. He said, you know, we'd probably like to see him. I go, he's alive? And he goes, yeah, he's upstairs. We're going to discharge him tomorrow. I went, what? Wait a minute. Are we talking about the same patient here? And I went up to visit him, and his brothers were in the room, and I was kind of awkward. Who are you? You know, and he had lost his memory for about 3 months prior to that, but he survived. But the Marine Medical Society made a big deal about it. So the Surgeon General came out and gave me a National Life-Saving Medal at a big event in San Rafael. So it was kind of cool.
Yes, very cool.
I thought maybe I should wear my life-saving badge around the inn, but I think it'd be a little too presumptuous.
Hikers take care of their own badge, yeah. Maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
How about, you've seen a lot of behavior. What would you say to the people that come up to this mountain, come up to the West Point Inn? What's your friendly advice to the people that come up here as in regard to how to behave on this mountain?
Well, first of all, don't smoke and don't throw trash down. That drives me crazy. I'm constantly picking up trash.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not as bad here as it is in a lot of places. But it's still,
I've seen some things, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I have too. I have seen all kinds of things. Yeah. And
some of them rather unpleasant.
Yeah. So it's not okay. You know, we've got bathroom facilities up here. There's no need to go to the bathroom outside, you know, at West Point Inn, and we're 2 miles from pretty much everything. I find most people are delightful. There's very few people that are obnoxious that come up here, and I think it's the nature of the mountain
mm-hmm.
that tends to pacify us as we, the higher up we get on the mountain, the more we climb, the better we feel about ourselves and our fellow man and nature.
Mm-hmm.
And just, this mountain has a magic to it that, it transforms people.
Mm-hmm. Did you find after Vietnam that your time on the mountain was soothing? Was it part of?
Oh, it probably saved my life. I had a really hard time in Vietnam. I had a young Vietnamese boy who gave up his life to save mine. I couldn't talk about it for years. I went through years of therapy at the VA hospital and medication and everything else to get through it. I was suicidal, even though my life is incredibly good.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a beautiful wife and children, you know, and I own a home in Marin, which is a huge blessing for somebody that came here with absolutely nothing.
And not too far from where you were sleeping.
No. It's less than a mile away. And so Mount Tam is it's a spiritual place.
Are there any people in particular that you remember that you've, you know, there's what I call mountain rats.
Yeah.
There's people on the mountain that just really it's their lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I've seen those folks hiking. I guess I'm one of those folks.
I was just going to say, well, there's Deborah Schwartz. There was a guy that worked for the water district when I was in the fire lookout. I cannot think of his name at the moment. It'll come to me.
Yes.
But just a wonderful man. And he would hike to the fire lookout every Sunday and bring me a piece of that German chocolate cake from the old Mountain Home Inn, the mm-hmm. old German place.
Mm-hmm.
And he would bring that up. And I would see him coming up and I would salivate. Because the cake, it was just so wonderful. I really look forward to him doing that. He's passed away a number of years ago, but he was one of the land managers up here in the watershed. And the rangers up here.
Mm-hmm. What rangers?
Well, a number of them. There was Moose, who's retired, and Larry Norrell, who saved me more than once. Before he was a ranger on Mount Tam, he was a lifeguard at Stinson Beach, and I've been surfing since 1965, and I got knocked out on my surfboard, and it was a foggy day, and I was out there with one other friend of mine who was down the beach a ways, and Larry just happened to see me and pulled me out of the water. I would have drowned. I had a knot the size of a softball on my head, but then he saved me another time on Hukuiku when I crashed my bicycle and got busted up pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Larry just happened to be driving down the mountain. I had coffee with him. I was on my way home from the firehouse, and I used to stop by here and have coffee mm-hmm. in the morning with the innkeepers, and Larry was here. And luckily, he went the same way I did, and so he brought me down to Marin General, and they patched me up. But Larry sticks out in my mind, and Moose was a character. Gordon Hassler, I don't know if you know that name, but Gordon and I actually, I was going to be a Mount Tam Water District Ranger, and took the test, and I would have gotten hired at the same time Gordon did, but I decided to go with San Anselmo Fire Department. Mm-hmm. So I worked in San Anselmo, which later became Ross Valley. And, you know, just even fighting fires on the mountain here. Do you remember Dowd's Furniture?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So the night that burned, I was the captain at Throckmorton. I was covering the station because there was a 40-acre wildfire going on just on the other side of Pantol. Mm-hmm. It was just burning the grass area over there mm-hmm. By Rock Springs. And so the guys had a cover, and they needed a cover. And so my engine company came up, and we're covering the Throckmorton station. And it's about 2-3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm looking over Mill Valley, and it's just kind of a red glow, and I'm going, there's something going on. That's not normal. And the rest of my crew was asleep, and I was going in to get them up, and all the alarms went off, you know. And,
this was the early 80s, correct?
Yeah, I think it was early 80s.
When the restaurant burned down and the Curtis Art Gallery as well, right?
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. And so I got down to the fire in Mill Valley, and Daryl Allerton was the chief on duty at the time. And we knew each other pretty well because we'd gone through fire science together. And I walked up to Daryl and I said, anybody covering the Sweetwater? And he goes, no, would you go check on it? So I went over there and pushed open the door and got in there, and the whole wall, because it was right next to
the
fire.
Back then, the Sweetwater was right on Throckmorton.
Yeah. So I got in the front door, and there were posters and stuff on the wall that was starting to curl and smoke. And it is a brick wall.
It's
considered what they call a 4-hour firewall, but that's mm-hmm. how hot that fire was. Mm-hmm. So I brought some hose lines in through there and up onto the roof of the Sweetwater, and so the people at Sweetwater made a t-shirt for me that said, I saved the Sweetwater.
You really ought to start wearing your garb once in a while.
Yeah.
That just with all the awards.
Yeah. Yeah. The fire marshal in Mill Valley at that time was a guy named Scott Myers. And he and I and the gal from Tiburon and the fire marshal from Coronado started the fire investigation team. And anyway, we were investigating that fire. And
oh, that was a suspicious circumstance.
It was very suspicious. I found 7 places where I detected the smell of kerosene and stuff.
Yeah.
And then at that time, the chief of Mill Valley said, that's it. And he called in ATF and kicked us. And they did their own investigation. They run in this dog sniffers. And mm-hmm. they found one more set. I found 7. And the dog found 8. So mm-hmm. we did a pretty good job. But after fighting the fire and then, you know, staying up all night and digging, I was exhausted because it was a long day.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was a suspicious fire. Yeah.
Yes. I actually know a little bit about that, but we want to go into that in our interview.
Yeah.
And how about the one thing that so many people love about the West Point Inn are the wonderful pancake breakfasts.
Yep. That was started by a fellow firefighter friend of mine, Pete Martin. He used to be in charge of the Throckmorton Fire Station, and he's been a member longer than I have of the West Point Inn. And Pete came up with the idea, because the fire department still did...
Always the pancake breakfast.
They do pancake breakfast. Yes. He said, we should do one at West Point as a fundraiser. And so Pete started all that. And so we've been doing that for a long time.
So describe that for those that are listening to this interview.
Well, our pancake breakfast, they start on Mother's Day. And we start 9:30 in the morning, 9:30 in the morning. And we usually go till 1 o'clock. And it's a fundraiser for the inn. And it's a good fundraiser. And the people of Mill Valley and Marin County really support the inn because they come out in droves. Mother's Day and Father's Day pancake breakfast, we generally... have over 1,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So all the labor up here, it takes a crew of 25 to do it. And everybody volunteers up here, and it's a lot of fun. They come up the night before, and we have a big party and sign jobs for everybody. And it all works like clockwork.
Yes.
It just comes together.
And for those that haven't been to the West Point Inn, for most people, except for the people that are bringing cooking materials or supplies or maybe handicapped parking, the people that come to breakfast, they have to hike or bike up here.
Yes, they do, and sometimes in the rain.
And sometimes in the rain.
Yep. There's been plenty of Mother's Days, and we started doing it on Easter Sunday because the one in October, it seems to get closed out more often than not
because of fire danger. Because of red flag warnings, yeah.
So, but we did that for two Easters, and it didn't work because it was either too foggy or too wet mm-hmm. up here at the time, and just a little too early in the season.
So it's such a time with those pancake breakfasts where children are really a lot of children up here.
There are, yep. And we use children to deliver my grandsons and my daughters when they were younger were up here helping
it's
with the pancake
really
breakfast.
It's really sweet when the kids come deliver your food
yep.
or help
and
you take
my grandsons are doing that now. And now my grandson that is 16 is got his time on the grill making pancakes. And so you kind of move up the scale and he loves it. And so afterwards, when I'm in charge of a pancake breakfast or up here, we always have leftover pancakes, and so we have a little contest with the kids and see who can throw a pancake down the Nora Trail the farthest.
And my grandson
holds the record by a lot. He was able to get this one pancake, and it just sailed off over the trees like a flying saucer and disappeared down Nora someplace. And of course, the raccoons and the coyotes love it.
Thank you. And how about the Heritage Nights?
Part of it, West Point, is the whole reason we exist is to preserve the history of this old, beautiful building. And Heritage Night is one of the highlights of the year, and it's usually sold out. We do it two nights. Our historian...
Once a year, is it? Just once a year? It's, no, it's more than that.
No, we usually just do it once a year. There may have been once or twice we did it twice, but they do it multiple nights, but it's same mm-hmm. lecture. And there's been some wonderful times. The 100th anniversary of the Titanic.
Beautiful. I was there.
You were here for that. So
sure,
that was a three-day celebration. And as you know, the members' lounge and parlor were all decorated in Titanic. Mm-hmm. I dressed up as a chief engineer. I had an old Australian firefighter's wool uniform with the brass buttons. And my wife... dressed up as Latricia, who was one of our ghosts that lives here at the West Point Inn.
And another ghost.
I haven't told you that story. So Washington Dodge is a very famous San Franciscan who went on the Titanic. And what I've heard is he was a doctor, and they had asked him to help out and be a doctor on the Titanic. So he was kind of considered a crew member. And when the Titanic went down, he wound up surviving in lifeboat number 13, which is a bit notorious because lifeboat number 13 just had crew members. And because he was a doctor and helping out, and I think his passage was probably paid for because he was a doctor. He wound up in that lifeboat. And that lifeboat was... because it was crew members, there were no women on it, and it was only half full. And the story was that they didn't pick up any survivors in the water. However, I doubt that there were survivors. Anytime there's a disaster, there's all kinds of stories that fly around that aren't necessarily true. But it really affected Washington, and he came back to San Francisco, and his friends, the Citros, the Floods, the Spreckles, that people that he hung out with, that's the crowd, because he was a very wealthy man, had a telegraph company, he owned a lot of buildings in San Francisco. And he tried to clear his name on this by speaking to the Commonwealth Club, and all this is available online. You can Google Washington Dodge, it. Quite a history. So he came up to and bought a little piece of property right here at West Point Inn and built a cabin. And the cabin, he finished it in 1918, started in 1917, and finished it in 1918. So the cabin is 100 years old now. And so that's our West Point Inn's Titanic tie. Well, he built the cabin, and then the next year...
I read the article. He killed himself.
He killed himself. He shot himself, not here at the inn, but at his house in San Francisco.
And then rode an elevator down to the basement.
Well, he shot himself in the basement. Mm. I think he pulled the elevator up or something. But yeah, he had a beautiful place right opposite St. Francis Hotel, beautiful Victorian. And, you know, pretty characteristic of a wealthy San Franciscan and well-known San Franciscan. So he built...
But how could he purchase... This is municipal water district land.
It wasn't at the time. This land was owned by... when the railroad owned it.
Oh, so when
the railroad owned it, and a lot of this land was owned by Senator Kent too.
Yes, right, Kent, because municipal water district, 1912, 1913 around there.
Yeah, but I think that after they kind of inherited this property after the railroad went out of business.
Oh,
but
that's 1929.
The water district didn't own this section. Yeah, the water district continues to expand its boundaries.
I see.
I don't think they are expanding anymore, but. Mm-hmm. This was not part of the water district.
Okay, I always wondered about that.
Yeah.
So the doctor died.
So he died. He died 2 weeks later in a hospital in San Francisco. But there's a story that I like to tell about when he was living up here, and his wife had divorced him, and he had this beautiful young lady that would take the train up to visit him on the weekends, and her name was Latricia. And she was very eccentric, very beautiful, had ivory white skin, long black hair, always showed up wearing a long red evening dress and opera length red evening gloves. And she would never talk to anybody on the train. Everybody would kind of look at her and, you know, because she just stood out.
She was a woman of mystery, yes.
Definitely a woman of mystery. And she came up, get off the train, walk over to Dodger's cabin, knock on the door, and then disappear, and then take the Sunday morning train back down.
So this was part of his therapy?
Never talked to anybody. And everybody, he of course, was quite the talk of the town. And so she came up one time and knocked on the door, and there was no answer. And so she just kind of stood there for a while, and then she walked up and talked to Martin Kiewig, who was the innkeeper. And... have you seen Washington? And Martin said, well, I guess you didn't hear. Washington had shot himself, and he was in a hospital and not expected to survive. So Latricia burst into tears, didn't get back on the train, and just wandered up the mountain somewhere off in the direction here of the Rock Springs Trail over towards the end, but she just left. Nobody ever saw her again. So... after a period of time, the inn took over the Washington's cabin and started renting it out. And whenever a woman would stay in that cabin, they would come back the next morning and there'd be, walk up to Martin and say, we found this in there. Somebody must have lost this. It was on the pillow. And it was a red opera mid-length evening glove. And it started happening more and more. And... it was happening up until about 2 years ago. So
is that when Amazon stopped selling red evening gloves?
No, it's when the gross of 144 evening gloves, I ordered 144 pair of them. And that so the Latricia story is figment of my imagination. And Washington Dodge's
story. Had me, though. I believed you, and I want to believe
you. And most
you.
Of my guests did. And so I would plant the red gloves. Uh-huh. And usually with friends, and then after a while, you know, I'd plant them ahead of time. And so I'd tell the story up here at
so
the inn,
awesome.
And they would go back there. And I started out with, we had work gloves, and it started out with a prank of the gal that was maid of honor at our wedding lives on a... in the middle of Ohio, and brilliant lady. She's director of nurses at a big hospital in Columbus, and I pulled the prank. She came out to visit, and she and her husband stayed in the honeymoon. I rented the honeymoon cabin for them, and so, of course, I had planted one of these red gloves, and that was the beginning of the red gloves story was when she was here, and she was terrified. Her husband was so mad at me the next night. They were having some marital issues, and they were just starting to really get things back together, and he was looking forward to a nice romantic night on the mountain. And his wife was up crying, wanted to leave. And, of course, I didn't know about this till the next morning. And so I was in the doghouse.
Yeah.
So
Just a little.
Anyway, she took the red glove. It was one of our work gloves. It was like a red mitten. And she took it with her. And years later, we went to Portugal and asked Faith if she wanted to go with us because she speaks fluent Portuguese after her time in South America in the Peace Corps. And so she went to Portugal with us, and we were in southern Portugal at this little inn that we were staying at. And I was sitting out on the deck having a beer and fell asleep, and I woke up, and here's my beer bottle with the red glove with the middle finger up on the red glove. So she got me back. But anyway, I manufactured the story, and I fine-tuned it over the years, and I've been through all 144 pairs of gloves. So, and well, I thought about ordering it again, but the board had asked me a couple of times, because I actually got complaints to the board about this because I scared people.
Yes, well, but when I bring my hiking groups up, they like the story.
Yeah, most people like the story.
But it can creep people out.
Yeah.
But apart from, I mean, I'm surprised there aren't more ghosts, because as nice as this place is, you'd think a couple of innkeepers would have liked to just set themselves back down for eternity.
Well, we did have a ghost called the Punctual Ghost. And this ghost would appear every night at 9:50, like clockwork. And people go, oh, come on. I said, every night, 7 days a week, this ghost, and it goes right through the parlor. It'll come in this north window right here and fly out the south window. And I said, if you don't believe me, you sit here and you watch. You got to be quiet. You got to be completely quiet. And so I would dim the gas lights down a little bit, and they're sitting in front of the fireplace, and everybody's just sitting there. And I said, you can't talk. You just need to sit here. And why? Why do we have to be quiet? I said, because the ghost makes a noise and you will hear it. And so we're all sitting there, and all of a sudden there's this a real high pitch, almost inaudible sound, and it's stereophonic, and you can hear it. It goes from the north window and goes out the south window. So
does the window have to be open?
No, it goes right through the window. And people would see it all the time. Now, I never saw it, but I heard it and I felt it. But I never saw it.
Well, what did they see?
They saw like a spirit go through the room.
Ooh.
So, yeah. So some people can see spirits, I guess. I couldn't. So I could see it go through this. So, and for the, you know, I don't quite buy into a lot of that stuff. I mean, there's strange things that happen that I can't explain, like tink, you know, in the window. But it was just bizarre, and I would hear it every night at the same time. So one night I was telling this story, and there was a man, we were talking earlier, and he worked for AT&T, the phone company. And so he's sitting there listening to me, and he, you know, we're quiet, and the ghost goes through the room. And he goes, oh, what a bunch of BS. He said, that's the tone that we send through the payphone. There was a payphone in that room at the time. And we send that tone through to see how much money went through the, most people don't know about this, and we don't want them to know about it, but this high-pitched tone, and they can tell how much money was deposited in the phone that night. So that's the way they keep track. but it does make a high-pitched sound, and it's usually inaudible, but in a quiet room, you know, you can hear it. So that was the Punctual Ghost. So they pulled the phone out, and the Punctual Ghost has not appeared since.
Oh, interesting. Ghostbuster.
I had no idea that that's what it was.
There are strange things done in the midnight. Yeah.
So I at least had a scientific explanation for that ghost. But people see it, Washington Dodge's spirit is, you can feel it. There's a presence up here. There's something, but and there's been a lot of people that have stayed in the honeymoon cabin, and where I haven't told them any stories or anything, and they have come up the next day. In January of 2010, I had a couple that were staying in there and hadn't talked to them. I just casually asked them, how'd you sleep, which I usually do. And, well, we didn't sleep very well. We had a ghost in the cabin. And I went, really? And I'd heard this before from people. And I said, so really, what'd you see? And they said, well, it was like a green cloud in the middle of the room. And there was like spirits in this cloud. And then there was a man's face. And I'm listening to him. I go, huh. You know, we know you don't believe me. And I said, we can't believe it either. But we took pictures. I said, really? So they had one of these digital cameras back then that was, you know, like 1 or 2 megapixel. And so they were trying to show me, and the screens were, you know, those little 2.5-inch screens. You could barely see anything. I said, do you mind if I download it into the computer? No, please do. We want some, you know, I want to see it, you know. And so we did. And I looked at it and I went, wow, there was a green cloud. And if you looked at it, it was almost like there was these green figures with two eyes. I mean, like what you'd picture a ghost and mm-hmm. stuff. And at one time I counted 20 in this image. And then one of the photos had a man with a bit of a beard. And it looks a lot like the portrait that Fred Renner found here recently. And that's now down in the honeymoon or in the cabin that he built.
Well, before I leave today, let's take a look. I would ask you more about this in itself, the history, but since you brought up Fred Renner, I'll say that I'm going to save some of that, those questions for Fred himself, since I'll be interviewing him.
Oh, yeah,
and absolutely. The history of the railroad.
Yeah, he's the man to talk to.
Yes, he really is the man to talk to, but he can't tell me about ghosts in the honeymoon cabin. Well, I suppose he could. He knows an awful lot.
Yeah.
Tell me, as we're getting close to closing up, I'm going to ask you a couple more questions,
sure.
Okay? I'm wondering if you could just give me a description of a day here as an innkeeper. Just
okay.
A quick description of that day. That day that, for whatever reason, stands out in your mind.
Oh, there's been so many that it's hard to pick.
Okay, well,
one particular day that stands out.
What it is about the days that stand out?
Well, the mornings, when the sun comes up in the morning. The innkeepers have their own room over here and a balcony, and the sun shines right in on you in the morning when it comes up. So we're usually up before sunrise to get the day going, and just watching the sun come up and then watching it go down in the evening from here. It's just magic. I mean, this is one of the best views in the world. I'm sure you've traveled, mm-hmm. and I hear that a lot. People mm-hmm. go, wow, this is the best view I've ever seen. And mm-hmm. it is. It's an incredible view, and it's just an incredible spot. And the weather just seems to be magical up here. Every day is different. Some days it's just wet and wild and crazy, and I love those days. And there's days where it's just warm and dead still. There are days where the wind drives me nuts,
mm-hmm.
And I don't enjoy those days as much, but it's still. And every day is different up here. It's one of the reasons I enjoy working up here. It's one of the reasons I enjoy being a firefighter, because every day is something different. There's mm-hmm. no routine. It's just you can expect something new to happen every day. So,
is there anything we haven't talked about that you'd like to say in conclusion with this interview?
Just that I feel extremely blessed to have wound up in Marin County. My mom, 2 days before she passed away, had told me, and mind you, my mom was a very prudish, strict, conservative Catholic, and never would talk about sex or anything like that. And she says, I know why you have such an affinity for Mount Tam. She said, because your father and I, my dad would drive a limo on his as a side job when I was going to school, and they would let him use the limo on the weekends, and my mom and dad would come up here, and she said, you were conceived on Mount Tam.
Wow. That sort of gets you right here, doesn't it?
Yeah, it kind of explains why I wound up here. So... And I meet people up here from time to time that Chris Chater is one of them
mm-hmm.
that I felt that I've known in the past. So I kind of think that we come back and we come back to the same place as we were before.
Beautiful. And I agree.
All right. Well, thank you, Deborah. This has been a nice... I need to get back to work as an innkeeper.
Yes, it's probably 3 o'clock and it's time for you to get back. I appreciate so much you taking a slice out of your day to share your tales, true and not so true,
yeah.
and your life experiences. I had no idea.
Yeah.
And I just want to thank you for being up here all the time. If I ever have a heart attack coming up Mount Tam, I hope I land right here. But yeah. Until then, I will say happy trails to you, and I will certainly be seeing you again.
Yes, you will. Yes, you will.
And thank you for your service, and thank you for making this place home to so many people from all over the world, because that's what you feel when you get here, like you've arrived home.
Yeah. It's and that's the way I want it to feel. I want people to feel like this is their place. Mm-hmm. And it is. We all own this building. Mm-hmm.
And the work parties are wonderful, and productive, and it's a community builder. This place is a place of gathering. It's a place of worship. It's a place of appreciation, and it's a place of solace and healing.
Yeah, it is all the above. Yes, and there's something. I mean, it's just a small part of Mount Tamalpais. But at the same time, it is it's a landmark, and it's a focus point of not just beauty, but of spirituality. So
I completely agree. So with that final thought, we shall conclude this interview. And on behalf of the Mill Valley Public Library and the Mill Valley Historical Society, I say thank you, and that's it.
It's been an honor. Thank you.
All mine.